I'm John Krall. Today, on this special recorded No Limits, we're going to talk again with author Michael Sheldon, who has written a fascinating book about an undiscovered chapter of the novelist Herman Melville's life. The book is called Melville in Love, and it is a revelation. Because this is a recorded show, we won't be taking questions or comments by phone, email, or social media, but we do hope you enjoy what promises to be a fascinating conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. This is a special No Limits. It's a recorded show, so we won't be taking calls or answering questions via email or social media today, but we hope you'll enjoy the conversation. We have returning with us Michael Sheldon, who is the author of several books, but most recently, Melville in Love, which is, I'm going to say at the outset here, a fabulous book. You should read it. It is going to change the way that we look at the life and career of Herman Melville and probably the way we read his books, most specifically Moby Dick. Michael, welcome back to the program. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And I will reiterate, I love the book. I really enjoyed reading it.
And I didn't have to pay you a thing
you
for
did
that,
not.
Did I?
No. You okay. did not. No. I want to start because you've uncovered what is this fascinating and undiscovered part of Melville's life that sort of illuminates the larger whole in ways that we wouldn't. I would attempt to describe that, but I don't want to give away, and I hate doing this because I know as a writer myself, I hate being asked the question, what's the book about? Because it's all that, but to observe the parameters and to avoid discouraging people from actually reading the thing, I want to ask, could you talk a little bit about the story you set out to tell here, and then we'll dive down into your specific discoveries.
I feel very fortunate to have stumbled across what I think is one of the great 19th century love stories. It's tempting to have called this book Sarah Morwood in Love, because she's the woman that had been completely forgotten in time. I mean, she's so completely in the past that when I found her grave in western Massachusetts in the Berkshires, it had split in two, and one part was leaning against the other and completely neglected weeds around. And I felt as though one of the missions I had for this book was to bring her story back, and especially the story of how she fell in love with Herman Melville when he was writing Moby Dick, and had a huge influence on the way that he saw the book, the way that he saw his career. It was a kind of love affair that was at first sight and so powerful, they were swept up into the drama of their own lives, and that drama got carried over into the incredible drama of Moby Dick, where, as you know the story, there's a pursuit of something you're never going to get. Mm-hmm. And it's a wild, manic pursuit. And some of that same energy from the romance got into the book, and I just thought, I've got to put this romance back together 150 years later if I can, and that's what I tried to do.
How did, I was going to ask how you found her, but I think we'll save that for a moment. And talk. We probably ought to talk a little bit about who she was, in many ways there was a star-crossed quality here, although there were issues of proximity and questions of social class and all of that came into play. Could you talk a little bit about who Sarah Morwood was?
She's a very attractive woman in her mid-20s who married a wealthy Englishman whose business interests were in New York, but to make her happy because she loved the country, he bought her a mansion and 250-acre estate in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts. And Melville showed up there one day on what he thought would be a one-week holiday, and fell in love with the woman who owned this mansion on the hill, and fell in love so much that within a month he put himself into huge debt in order to buy the adjoining farm, which was 160 acres, and he knew nothing about farming. He was in his early 30s. He was a former sailor. He knew the sea. He didn't know the
land. Pretty much a city boy before that,
yeah.
Too. So.
Yeah. He knew the sea. He didn't know the land. He knew the sea and the city, but not the land. And it was a crazy thing to do. His wife, he had been married for 3 years. His wife was flabbergasted. She had no idea why he was dragging her from New York, where they lived, up to Western Massachusetts to live next to this lady on the hill. But she went along with it, not suspecting that there was a deeper reason for the move. And there, a lot of people don't know this, there he wrote Moby Dick in a house on that farm of 160 acres. Looking out over the Berkshires, he wrote this great novel of the sea.
And how did you find this story? Because it is, there have been books written about Melville before. After I read yours, I dipped into, for example, Lewis Mumford's book and looked a little bit at Del Banco's book about him. And there are some allusions, obviously, to the fact that even in Mumford's book, which kind of surprised me given that it was published in 1929, that Melville was, not exactly as chaste as a monk, given the constraints. But nobody had tumbled upon this love affair beforehand, or the sort of cataclysmic effect it had on one of our great writers' lives.
It's very rare when you discover something that's this old, that happened 150 years ago, and really no one had mentioned it before. And it came to me because for about 3 years I was traveling extensively with my previous book on young Winston Churchill. And I'd been giving talks in Massachusetts, especially in Boston. And at the time I was kind of wandering around looking at various things. I was amazed to find out that Moby Dick had been written in the Berkshires, and I thought that's fascinating. I was dimly aware of it, but not as aware of it as I should have been. And I stopped at one of the local libraries there and discovered they had a Melville room full of memorabilia and various manuscripts. And it was a discovery that I couldn't walk away from. I kept going through their files, looking at their materials, discovered some of the love letters that Melville had written to Mrs. Morwood, to Sarah Morwood, and was astounded at the sheer exuberance of those letters, where he calls her my goddess, my enchanted woman, the lady of paradise. And I thought, this man's in love. Mm-hmm. What's going on, and why haven't we heard about it? So that's why I started digging, and the more I dug, the more I found.
Were you a Melville devotee before you started this work? What drew you to telling Melville's story?
Yes. No, I loved Melville. I especially loved the early novels, Typee, about his adventures in the Pacific. And I was a fan of some of the short works like Billy Budd. But I had never really understood Melville's life, and most people had not, because as a result of this love affair, he sacrificed everything he had. And when it all collapsed, when, in fact, Moby Dick turned out to be a huge commercial flop, he suffered so greatly, his career was essentially washed up and ruined while he was still in his 30s. And he ended his days, as you know, as a customs officer in New York City, so completely forgotten that the New York Times said most people thought he was dead long before he actually died. And I felt, why did this man suffer this kind of collapse after writing these magnificent things in Moby Dick? And, of course, part of the answer had to do with the collapse of his love affair, not because they fell out of love, but because they weren't allowed to love.
Well, and she did not live a long life herself.
She died at the age of 40. They were together for 13 years. It was a hidden love affair. It was a great secret. The two of them tried to carry on. They had between them 400 acres. She was an expert rider, and the two of them, she on side saddle, he on a regular horse, would ride around and discover the countryside together. Both of them were married. Her husband was mostly absent. His wife was, to put it mildly, long-suffering, mm-hmm. and probably knew what was going on after a while, but put up with it. And the love was something neither of them could stop. They felt it so deeply that they just couldn't break apart. He moved there a few months after she moved there. He left when she died.
You've mentioned Melville's marriage, and we probably ought to get it, since there are Melville devotees out there. You know, one of the things that at least has been a somewhat difficult issue, I think, in Melville scholarship is how to deal with his marriage, because there were allegations of domestic abuse, apparently some plot that his wife concocted to fake a kidnapping or whatever so she could get away from. Could you talk a little bit about the nature of that union and who his wife was?
Like a lot of people, those two people, Melville and his wife, Elizabeth, should never have gotten married. They were completely incompatible. She was a very plain, down-to-earth woman. He had an imagination that was like wildfire. She was a very sober judge's daughter, and he was this wild man who had been in the Pacific and sailed the oceans. And he soon realized after a couple of years of marriage he had made a huge mistake, and that's when Sarah comes along. And that relationship sustained him. But after her death, after Sarah's death, he fell apart. And within a few years of her death, his marriage just went to hell. I mean, the two of them fought. At one point, Lizzie's family wanted to abduct her. They wanted to take her away. I don't think that was necessary. There's no evidence that he laid hands on her, but there were some pretty nasty arguments between them. And at one point, their teenage son was apparently so enraged by some of the things going on that he took his own life. And that sobered both of them up, both husband and wife. And they had a kind of uneasy truce for the rest of their years together. Melville lived to be his early 70s, and his wife went on and lived another 10 years. But their marriage was not happy almost from the start, and those 13 years with Sarah were the most productive of Melville's life. That's when he wrote all of his great works. And it's partly, I think, because of the kind of relationship he had discovered, but he was never going to be able to enjoy it fully.
And I want to talk a little bit about that relationship and how that period... When you were writing the book, that period in which he knows Sarah is the focus of the book. And that's the way you often tell stories in your books. You look at a specific period in a person's life and use that kind of as a window on the entire experience. How did you decide when to cut this off? Because there is a little bit of before and there is a little bit of after. But a lot of it really is focused on this really intense relationship and the effect it had on these two people.
It's one of those things I think a lot of people experience, or if they don't experience, they're a bit envious of it. That moment where you walk into a room and there she is, or there he is, the love of your life. Your eyes lock onto each other, and it's one of those great romantic feelings. That was exactly what Melville experienced and what Sarah experienced. And I wanted to walk you right into that moment. I've been in the house. The house is still pretty much there where they met and fell in love. That was her house. It's today the Pittsfield Country Club. And the golf course is in the back where they used to ride their horses. And just below is Melville's house. So you can walk these grounds and walk through the woods and see everything pretty much that they would have seen. And that's what I wanted to do for the reader, is put you there and let you fall in love along with these two people and experience that face-to-face almost.
What was it like? I mean, because presumably you'd sort of discovered the story of the love affair through the letters, through the written word, but being in the place where those two people that you are now studying intensely walked, breathed, you know, bled, lived. What was that like for you?
Oh, amazing, especially to go up to 3,000 feet up to Mount Greylock, which is the highest point in Massachusetts. It's 15 miles away from where Sarah and Melville lived, and they spent one very memorable night there on the top of that mountain without their spouses but with a few other friends. And that night was wild. I mean, it was almost the night they'd been dreaming of that they could have together. And Melville felt it was the kind of the triumph that he had earned by writing Moby Dick, because from his window at his house, you can still see this today, you look out on Mount Greylock. And it's almost as after finishing the book, he wanted to conquer the mountain as well. So this incredible woman climbs a 3,000-foot mountain with Melville, and they spend the night there together. That's unheard of for Victorian women, mm-hmm. for the women of that period to do that. But she wanted to do it for him, and she did.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with the author of a great new book, Melville in Love. The author's name is Michael Sheldon. He teaches at Indiana State University. This is a recorded program, so we're not taking questions via phone, email, or social media. But we do hope you are enjoying the conversation. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking with Michael Sheldon today on No Limits. He is the author of several books, most recently Melville in Love, a brand new book that explores a completely missing chapter in Herman Melville's life that illuminates the rest of it. This is a recorded program, so we're not taking questions via phone, email, or social media, but we hope you'll enjoy the conversation. Just before the break, we were talking about the feeling you got of walking around. You said you'd been a fan of Melville's work. How did, after you made this discovery, presumably because I know from previous conversations with you, you're incredibly thorough when it comes to your research, I'm presuming you reread all of Melville's work after that. How did it change the way you approached his work?
Oh, you see everything differently. I mean, it's an amazing experience to have finished this book and go back and read Melville because, for example, there are no major female characters in Moby Dick, and yet the presence of a woman is there in many ways. And in fact, a lot of women who've read that novel have felt that there was some sort of erotic energy there. They couldn't place it. They couldn't put their finger on it. But they've written about it, and they've said, I feel it. Now I know why they feel it. Mm-hmm. It is a kind of a rush that you feel in that book that's something akin to what you feel in the middle of a romance. And it's interesting that Melville reacted to that in such a visceral way. His style before Moby Dick is almost subdued compared to what it is in Moby Dick. There's a sense of release. And it made a difference, by the way, that Sarah herself was a poet. Because unlike the judge's daughter to whom he's married, the poet in Sarah was beautiful. I mean, she had a great awareness of English literature and American literature up to that time. She had a great sense of turning a phrase, of the magic of words. And sharing that with him, I think, made a huge difference. In fact, we know that he borrowed lines from some of her poems in his own poetry he wrote later in his life. So we know the influence that she had on him, and you can see it in the kind of lyricism that we get in Moby Dick.
Yeah, I reread in addition to reading your book, I reread Moby Dick for the first time in several years, at least since I was in grad school. And I got to admit, after reading your book, it did change. I completely missed the exuberance. I think the playfulness mm-hmm. in the language. I mean, and the forms. I mean, the things he's doing, and you know, from chapter to chapter, where he switches voices and does all kinds of things that almost anticipate modernist literature ahead of time. Just I think flew over my head when I was a young man and read it, and I think you're right that all of that, you know, had to have been a product of something that was going on in his life. What other things, having now uncovered this, what other things about Melville do you think we have missed?
Well, when you read Melville in the old way, you see somebody who seems rather conventional in many ways. But once you understand, especially this poetic influence that's coming from this romance, you see a far greater depth of feeling there. There isn't the kind of detached character that I think some critics have made Melville out to be, much too serious. He is, in fact, as you said, a playful man in many ways. He's got a great sense of humor. And you become much more aware of that once you understand the context in which Moby Dick was written. The poetic side of all this can't be underestimated, because one of the great scenes in their love affair that I began the book with is the moment where Melville arrives at her house for a Christmas dinner right after Moby Dick has been published, and it's a flop, and the bad reviews are coming in, people misunderstood it, it was far too exuberant for most people at the time. And guess what? Sarah is waiting there with a garland, a laurel wreath that she's made to place on his head, like a poet of old who would wear his laurel wreath as his crown. She puts that on his head before dinner in front of everyone. She's invited some of the big shots from town, and her own husband is standing there. And they're all wondering what the hell is going on between these two. And to now know what
probably
was...
Probably not wondering for long.
No.
But yeah.
But to now know is amazing.
Well, and I guess what I wonder out of that is, and we talked about this a little bit before we went on the air, you know, this chapter that you've discovered, this love affair in Melville's life, is probably going to push people to reexamine everything that he wrote, probably a lot of the scholarship that has been done on his life. I'm not sure exactly how I want to frame this question, but it gets to how much of the past is unknowable. How much, you know, I'm thinking, for example, of another historic figure, Thomas Jefferson, you know, destroyed all of the letters that he and his wife wrote to each other because he wanted to keep that part of his life hidden from what he called prying eyes, the prying eyes of posterity. You know, absent this discovery by you, he could have continued reading Melville the same way. How much else do you think is out there?
Oh, my God. In most cases, this is my sixth biography, and in most cases, I realize how fragile the past is, that if you overlook this letter or you overlook that particular diary or journal, you might miss the huge drama in a life, the defining drama. I discovered something similar in young Churchill's life, where he had fallen in love with the then prime minister's daughter, and she had almost committed suicide when he married another woman. And that was quite controversial at the time, all now completely confirmed, and the discovery I'd made about that was in the Oxford Bodleian Library. Well, many of the discoveries for this were in Massachusetts, and they were in archives that are so fragile. One of them is lining the basement wall of Melville's old home. Boxes are piled up there, and periodically that area floods. And the people of the Berkshire County Historical Society or worried about those documents. I would be too. It's the largest collection of Sarah Morwood's letters there in a box. And to get to those and to be able to go through them before anything happened to them was a great relief. But it shows you what you're up against. Documents disappear, things fade away, memories go, and the next thing you know, the past, which might have a key to it, which would unlock a whole story, disappears.
In terms of dealing with this, I mean, what was your feeling like when you uncovered those documents, when you found this hidden love affair? I mean, was it like Eureka or
yes.
What?
Yes. When you hold letters of this kind, when you sit and look at the handwriting of someone who's been dead 150 years and you realize the emotion pouring off the page, that's quite something. That's a huge experience to have yourself. And it's what you want to convey in the book. You want the story of their love affair almost to read like a novel. You want people to feel that they're following as they would a great story, but have everything, including dialogue, whatever is said, be from the documents, be from the actual record. And that's part of the challenge and part of the fun of doing this. And in order to do that, you've got to dig up the material. You've got to go to these places, sit in these archives, and come back with the written words that will allow you to tell this story. And that's what I tried to do.
And, well, obviously the relationship between Sarah and Melville is the centerpiece of the book. There's at least one other complicated relationship in there, too, that I found fascinating, and that is Melville's, I guess you can call it a friendship, but I keep searching for some other other word that conveys how complicated his relationship was with Nathaniel Hawthorne, who is also a neighbor of his. And in fact, Moby Dick is not dedicated to his wife or to Sarah, but to Hawthorne.
It sounds as though you're making this up because, you know, two guys walk into a bar, Nathaniel Hawthorne and Herman Melville, right? And yet that's exactly what happened. When Melville moved to the Berkshires, not only was Sarah living next door after he bought the farm, but 6 miles away in Lenox was then the great author of American literature, Nathaniel Hawthorne, who had just written The Scarlet Letter. And scholars have known this for ages, and they thought for many years the reason he moved to the Berkshires was to be near Hawthorne. Well, Hawthorne's 6 miles away, and in those days, 6 miles is a long way. And if you want to move next to your hero, that's not moving next to him at all. In fact, he moved next to the woman he loved. But they were fascinated, both Sarah and Melville, by Hawthorne and became friends with him, in part because he was known at that time as the author of the book about American adultery. Mm-hmm. I mean, The Scarlet Letter
still is the book about
is
America.
The book.
Yeah.
So imagine two people who've fallen in love but who are married to other people suddenly discovering that they're going to have to cross that line in a New England that's still very much Puritan in its character. And down the road lives the man who's captured that spirit of guilt and sin in The Scarlet Letter, and they can talk to him. So Melville was fascinated by that and kept trying to sort of pull information out of Hawthorne, who was happily married, not at all interested in an affair. And yet he was a sounding board for Melville. Imagine if you can, entering into some sort of illicit affair like this, and your advisor is Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what was there.
Well, and it's odd because in reading the book, what comes across is if there's an unrequited love affair there, it's Melville toward Hawthorne, that Hawthorne was much more the standoffish figure in that relationship, and there was almost a puppyish quality to Melville's pursuit of him. Can you talk a little bit about the nature of that very complicated relationship?
It's almost an embarrassment of riches for Melville. Mm-hmm. He spent much of his life alone at sea, alone in his room writing, and suddenly he's got a male friend who's amazing, who's one of the great writers in history, and he's got this woman who understands him and who writes poetry and can inspire him, and the two of them live within, you know, visiting distance at any one time. He wants to bring them all together. He wants to feel as though they're all part of some kind of union, but Hawthorne doesn't want to play that game. He doesn't like it at all. He's very much aware that I think Melville was crossing a line, and he didn't want to be a part of that. So sure enough, within a year, Hawthorne clears out. He moved to the Berkshires only for a year, the year in which Melville is writing Moby Dick. And as soon as the book is finished and dedicated to him, he pretty much says to Melville, I'm out of here, and disappears.
And you mentioned the fact, and we probably ought to make this clear too, that Hawthorne had this perception that Melville was crossing a line. It wasn't just the line of adultery. There were some very significant social consequences. Melville's wife was the daughter of a very prominent man.
Here again, the story sounds almost incredible that you're making it up, but her father, the judge, is not just the judge. He is the greatest judge in Massachusetts. He's the head of the Massachusetts Supreme Court. He lives on Beacon Hill in a mansion, which is still there, and I've been to that. And it sits right behind the state house where he would hold court down the road. He's a powerful figure, And if you are caught in some adulterous affair and you make a fool out of the greatest judge in the state, there's going to be trouble. And Melville was certainly aware of that, and I think Hawthorne was very much aware of that, and thought that whatever game Sarah and Melville were playing, he didn't want to be caught in between, because as the author of The Scarlet Letter, people would immediately begin to ask questions. You know, he would be drawn into this. He had been identified with the subject matter, though not with the actual behavior. And I think he was a very sharp fellow who thought, whatever these two are up to, I don't want to be caught in the middle. And he cleared out.
Well, and he was, Hawthorne, if I'm, correct me if I'm not mistaken, was somewhat politically connected himself, too.
He was.
And that he, I think he wrote Franklin Pierce's campaign biography, didn't he?
Yes, he went to school with Franklin Pierce, and Pierce appointed him U.S. Counsel to Liverpool. And the last time Melville saw Hawthorne, it was in Liverpool, several years after they met in the Berkshires. So there is a very important connection between these two major American writers. And by the way, 35 miles away from where they are is Emily Dickinson in Amherst. So you've got three of the biggest figures in American literature within, you know, a day's ride of each other. And I just find that part of Massachusetts, which a lot of people love, fascinating in itself. Mm-hmm. And to go there and be able to recreate this story involving Hawthorne, Melville, and this new figure, Sarah Morwood, was just a gift.
One of the revelations for me in the book, and this was one of the conceptions I had about Melville, is that he had always labored or written in some obscurity, and that it was only well after his death that he was discovered. In fact, as you point out, he did have a fair amount of celebrity early on in his career. What we now think of as his tremendous artistic triumph was actually the death of that celebrity, Moby Dick. What accounted, do you think, for his long slide into kind of oblivion? I mean, it's in a way a minor miracle that he was rediscovered and that we're still talking about him.
He gave up. Mm-hmm. I think Edison says the only thing that can really lead to failure is to give up, that you keep trying. And Melville was so devastated by Sarah's death, he essentially gave up. And he became a character like his famous character, Bartleby, the Scribner, whose famous reply is, "I prefer not to." When he's offered any kind of work, he just says, "I prefer not to." And it was almost Melville's feeling as well, that he didn't see the point anymore of doing the kind of work he had done, because the greatest work, the masterpiece, wasn't appreciated, Moby Dick, and subsequent books weren't appreciated. And I think once you lose the reason you were living, and that's really what Sarah was for him, he gave up and eventually took this job with the Customs Service. U.S. Customs Service has a big website, mm-hmm, devoted to the fact that they once employed Herman Melville. But I love the fact that when Melville went to work the first day down in the docks in New York, a fellow writer saw him there and said, "What are you doing here?" As though to say, "What happened to you?" And the answer, of course, was he had been disappointed, and he was a proud man, and the disappointment both in his career and his love led him basically to walk away from his career.
Was it hard, to like him or to sympathize with him at that point, as you're right, trying to tell his story?
I don't think I've ever said this, and as I said, this is the sixth biography I've written, but I fell in love with him. I think he's an amazing character, and I feel so much for what happened to him, because it was a case in which he felt he had found his muse. He had found the woman who he was meant to be with, and he couldn't have her. Couldn't have her in all the ways that he wanted to have her, as his wife, as his lover, as his muse, as everything. And the heartbreak of that is extraordinary. And I think when you combine that with his ambitions as a writer, it becomes a tale that certainly I can identify with, of what, how much of your life you put into your books and how much of that life you treasure and want to see succeed. When it doesn't, you're devastated, and he was.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Michael Sheldon. He is the author of several books, but most recently, Melville in Love, which is a look at the life of Herman Melville that's going to change the way we look at Melville's life and the way we read his books. This is a recorded No Limits, which means we are not taking questions or comments via phone, email, or social media, but we do hope you are enjoying the conversation. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. This is a recorded No Limits, which means we are not taking calls or comments via phone, email, or social media. We're talking today with Michael Sheldon, who is the author of several biographies, most recently Melville in Love, which is a brand new book, just came out a couple of weeks ago. That explores a completely missing chapter in Herman Melville's life, a love affair that we did not know about, that illuminates not just his work, but his life and character in ways that we have not seen before. Before we went to the break, we were talking really about sort of the almost hothouse quality of the relationships involving Melville, his lover, Melville's friend, Nathaniel Hawthorne, relationship with Melville's wife. I think probably the best way to get at the atmosphere and really the spirit of your book is to ask you to read just a little bit of it. What section would you choose to read?
Yeah, I'd just like to read a bit of the beginning where Sarah is hosting Melville on Christmas Day in front of many of the prominent people of the town, basically to crown him in front of them so as to say, you may not care for this new book, but I do, and this is my poet laureate, in a sense. And this is how the book begins. It's called The Laurel Wreath. It is a winter scene like one you'd find in a faded calendar of old New England. A snowstorm has swept through the countryside overnight, sending the temperature plummeting and turning the landscape white. And there, on a gentle rise in a valley between two mountains in the Berkshires, is an old colonial mansion with plumes of smoke rising from its tall chimneys and guests arriving in sleighs for Christmas dinner. The year is 1851, and the house is the pride of Pittsfield, the nearest town on this western edge of Massachusetts. Lately christened Broadhall by its new owners, the elegant mansion has two grand parlors with fancy chandeliers separated by a wide hall and a solid old staircase. It was built by expert craftsmen using huge oak timbers from the area, and the upper windows command a sweeping view of the snow-covered mountains and fields that spread out in all directions. To the north, about a mile away, the church towers of the little town dot the horizon.
That was Michael Sheldon reading from his new book, Melville in Love, which explores an previously undiscovered love affair that Herman Melville had with his next-door neighbor. You've mentioned that Sarah was a poet herself and wrote some, you know, powerful letters. Do you think that there is a place for publishing her in this world, too? I mean, is she a talent who has not gotten her due in her own right? Or is she primarily sort of an appendage to the Melville story?
She's one of those victims of the passage of time. A lot of her poetry is in fragments. A lot of it is on the backs of letters or in books that were written in the backs of the books. So that she's difficult to recover at this point for any kind of major publication. But I've tried to indicate through quoting some of her lines in the book the quality of what she wrote. She wasn't a great poet by any means, but she certainly was good enough to be an inspiration to a man who needed some sort of connection to somebody who was as literary as he was. And he didn't have that from his own wife. He didn't have that from most of his friends. But when he ends up in the Berkshires with Hawthorne on the one hand and Sarah on the other, he feels finally completely connected. And what we got as a result, I think, is Moby Dick.
I've spent a lot of time so far talking about the research you've done and the discovery. Need to give the quality of the writing in your book its due, too. I mean, there is a very almost lyrical quality to the way you tell the story that is powerful, even apart from the quality of the research. What, you know, in some ways, those are techniques that are more associated with fiction. What is it that drew you to biography in the first place?
I love reality. I love telling real stories, but telling them in a way that feels like fiction. And when I'd finished my book on Churchill, which is called Young Titan, I felt so much that it was cinematic that I went to London and had an interview with the company that makes Downton Abbey, Carnival Films. And they bought the film rights to Young Titan. And they've since commissioned a script for the a six-part miniseries of Young Titan. And we're still hoping to get it made. It's one of these things where you start one of these projects and years later the thing actually ends up on the screen. But Carnival's pretty committed to it. And now that Downton Abbey is over, who knows? But I wanted, when I set out to write the next book, this book on Melville, to bring to it the same sort of cinematic quality, to put you there, to make you feel as though you were watching these events unfold before your eyes. And in order to do that, I wanted to capture some of that lyrical feeling that the landscape has, that the characters have. And if I may, I'll just give you one example of that. Years after Sarah dies, Melville goes back to the Berkshires. It's almost painful for him to do so, but he does. And he stands on the shores of a lake right outside of Pittsfield, where they used to go boating and enjoy their life together. And he's having a vision. He writes about it in a poem. And in the vision, a beautiful woman emerges from the woods and comes to him. And she's got a laurel wreath crown on her head. And as she comes to him, she gets so near his face to kiss him that the crown seems to rise over her head and onto his as well, as though both of them are being crowned at the same time. And instead of whispering something in him that would have, to him, that would have been, a sort of inspiration, she just says probably what he needed to hear, which is two words. She whispers to him, "Let go." And I think what she wants to say, if she's a vision that he thinks is speaking to him from beyond, is it's time to let go of this thing that's ruled your life. And of course, the answer is he can't let go. And the poem is part of that. But to set that scene at the lake where I've stood, on those banks of that lake and the shores of that lake, and to feel what it might have been like for this old man to show up and entertain thoughts of his youth and of the woman he loved, and to see this image appear before him, that's pretty good stuff. I like that. And I like being able to do that. But I didn't have to make it up. It was there in the poem.
You mentioned the fact that you like reality and you're drawn. You've written several biographies now, six, by, as you mentioned. Most recently, you did Churchill book, which is also is a stunning piece of work. And then the one where I discovered you, the biography of Mark Twain in his later years. What draws you to your subjects? I mean, what is the hook that has to pull you in? Because it's not an insignificant commitment to try to tell somebody's life story.
It's the life of the imagination. It's the ability to look at the world in front of us and see another world almost overlaid. It's that sense that Churchill had, unique among politicians, I think, is that he had a great imagination. And that imagination is what I value. It's a sense our other life. And in, I think whenever we fall in love, whenever there's some great affair in our lives or romance, part of what's operative there is the imagination. And I love exploring what the imagination can do once it goes to work on our everyday lives.
Who is next, do you think? I'm assuming this is not your last book or the last life that you're going to be fascinated by.
No, and I keep going back and forth almost between the English characters who I love. I've written about Orwell and Churchill, and then these Americans like Twain and now Melville. But I think I want to stay within America, and I'm fascinated by the early life of Franklin Roosevelt when he could walk, when he ran for vice president as a person who had not yet suffered from polio, and then what happened to him when he suddenly fell down one day and couldn't get back up. The effort to restore his life, to reclaim it, and go on to be president four times, to get elected to office four times, is an amazing story. And I think we all know about what happened to him when he became president. But it's that period leading up to that where you have to reconstruct your life. And I think that's partly involving the use of the imagination. You've got to see a person who can be a commander in chief, even though you can't even get out of your wheelchair, which was his case. So you have to imagine another life for yourself. By the same token, Emily Dickinson also interests me now, because she lived almost entirely in her imagination. And it's almost an imagination that's as powerful as any life could be lived on the daily surface of things.
In terms of who is sort of the... I'm going to pretend you're Ahab here. who is the great white whale, the subject that is out there that you would really love to do someday that at least at this time eludes you, you think?
Fitzgerald, F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Funny. I almost predicted that. Yeah. I could have predicted that. Why?
He's the American dreamer. He epitomizes what Americans mean when they talk about dream. They don't just mean material things. They mean ambition on such a wide scale that anything's possible. Steve Jobs is a kind of American dreamer as well. We manufacture these people. And Fitzgerald captured in The Great Gatsby a lot of what we think is necessary for that kind of life. And I think to get at him, to get inside of his life and talk about the way he looked at the world from the inside out, that would be amazing. I think he would be the epitome of the kind of person I'd like to get inside of, if it's possible.
What period of his life would you look at, do you think?
Oh, I think his life is short enough. It's like Orwell's life.
He's 44, I think, when he dies.
Yeah, you start at the beginning and you end with Sheila Graham, the English gossip columnist, holding him in his arms as he dies from a heart attack in the Hollywood Hills.
What is the part of the Fitzgerald story you think that people least understand now?
Well, probably his relationship with Zelda. I think they've over-romanticized it. I think in many ways he was always in love with a woman that he had known in his early teens and late teens, a woman he fell in love with named Ginevra King. And many people think she's the inspiration for Daisy in The Great Gatsby. And I once was at a dinner in Chicago giving a talk, and the woman next to me, quite old, said she was from an area of Chicago where I knew Ginevra had lived. And I mentioned her, and she said, oh, I knew her. She knew her back in the 60s. And Ginevra, I think, died in the 70s. So it was amazing to talk to somebody who knew the inspiration for Daisy in The Great Gatsby.
Well, and there's some parallels there with Melville, too, in that Gatsby clearly was not a success either when it came out, and it pretty much shattered Fitzgerald when it was published and was not received with the kind of acclaim he thought it should have.
Well, the famous story when he's with Sheila at the end of his life, they go into a bookstore and they can't find any of his books. They're all out of print. So, you know, he suffered the same thing. America's not very kind to writers of great imagination. It takes a long time for us to learn to read them. And I think we finally learned to read Melville. And I'm thankful that we've also learned to read Fitzgerald. It seems now if we could get back into the life, we might understand it a little better.
And in terms of Emily Dickinson and FDR, the two books that you're... It sounds like you're weighing back and forth right now. Talked a little bit about, obviously, Franklin Roosevelt and sort of the man he was before uncovering that, how many of the elements he was. What is it about Dickinson? What facets of her life do you want to bring to the fore?
You know, there is always the case with these people that they're one of a kind. You won't find them again. And Emily Dickinson is the kind of person you'll never meet again. I mean, she didn't meet that many people while she was alive, but if we could meet her, I think we'd be aware of the fact she was so odd and also magical that we'd never see that kind of person ever again, that particular kind of person. And I like that idea of taking you into the reader, you the reader, into a life that maybe existed just once, just this way once, and getting to know that life. The best thing anyone ever said about one of my books, they said about the book on Twain, they said at the end of it, they felt as though they could brush the cigar ashes from his cigar from their sleeves. They'd been so close to him in the course of that book. And that's what I want to do. I want to leave you with the sense that you've spent time with this person and you've gotten to know them.
And because the Melville book is out, and I selfishly want to encourage people to go read it because it is a great book, what do you think the biggest surprise or revelation that people will take away from your treatment of Melville that they just didn't get before?
Well, some of the old diehard Melville critics don't get it either. They think of him as a tough guy, not someone who would have this sentimental side. And I think to see that Melville was all for love, that this mattered to him. He wasn't just the old gnarly sailor who lived his life then in a kind of hermit-like state on land. He was a vital, vibrant character with a great love affair. And that's such a reversal for many of the Melville scholars that it's hard for them to get their heads around on. But the evidence is there, and it's pretty overwhelming.
Have you gotten pushback from them yet? Has there been any feedback from, as you say, the Melville school, as it were?
No, all the reviews have been great, but I get the sense that some of the older Melville types are a little grumpy about this, and perhaps why didn't they notice it?
Well, yeah, you probably can see that. And you'd mentioned earlier that was somewhat a product of the fact that he did drift into obscurity, and it's just hard to find some of the information.
Very hard. So it was something that, for a window in time for me, I was able to seize it and do something with it.
Well, again, I'd like to thank you for coming in and talking with us today. I really, really did enjoy your book, although I've got to say I've read three of them and there hasn't been one I haven't enjoyed yet. If you have been listening, you know that we have been talking with Michael Sheldon. He is the author of Melville in Love, a brand new book that uncovers a missing chapter in the life of Herman Melville. This was a recorded program, and we will be back next Tuesday.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cerzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.